This will be discussed in more detail along with some of the conventions that I used in the lecture last time. But just to summarize, the standard model, the forces in the standard model are described by a gauge theory, by Yang-Mills theory, with an SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 symmetry. The SU3 part is QCD. The SU2 cross U1 part accounts for the weak interactions and the electromagnetic interactions. And then the matter content in the standard model comes in three generations. So there's three copies of spin half matter with the following field content. And in essence, at low energy, and we'll study this using effective field theories next week, but at low energy, the electroweak sector is broken by a Higgs mechanism. Okay, it's broken down to electromagnetism, and then the electromagnetic charge, or the generators that are respected by the vacuum, are a combination of weak isospin and hypercharge in the following form. And then at low energies, around a GeV or a little less, the SU3 interactions become strong, and all particles that are charged into those interactions confine into SU3 singlets. And so these are the QQ bar mesons and the baryons. Okay. Now the standard model itself, when I say the standard model, that's usually in reference to all of this with a minimal Higgs field. So last time I introduced just a single Higgs doublet scalar field that in the vacuum acquires an expectation value that breaks this SU2 cross U1 symmetry. And in the process, its Yukawa couplings to the fermions generate masses that also violate SU2 cross U1. Okay. Now I want to pick up where I left off, working out the kinetic terms in the Higgs sector to see how they give mass to the W and the Z, well, how they give mass to three of the gauge bosons in the SU2 cross U1 sector. And then I'll summarize how the masses work out in the fermion sector and group the left-handed particle content that's written here into a more familiar-looking form where we'll see that the fermions combine into Dirac fermions with Dirac mass terms. Okay? Yeah? Because in principle, there could be more than one Higgs field. And also, the way that the fermions acquire their masses in an SU2 cross U1 violating way, those can involve, in principle, different fields than the fields responsible for giving mass to the W and Z boson. Okay. Yeah?
It's not absolutely clear to me from Yessa's lecture that it's that particular generator that's invariant. It's still invariant.
Sorry, the I3 plus Y combination?
Right.
Okay.
You probably said this.
Yeah, so let me write down, let's go back, I'll answer your question in just a second, then it might become a little bit clearer. Okay, so we started last time with some minimal Higgs potential. So when we minimize the Higgs potential and we look for minimal energy configurations, that means we look at configurations where the gauge fields are all gauge equivalent to zero, and we look for constant solutions of the Higgs field so that the kinetic terms don't contribute to the energy. And we find a whole family of solutions that are all gauge equivalent to one another. Okay? So what we can do is we can pick any convenient expansion about any solution. And so I'll use what's known as a Kibble parameterization for expanding the degrees of freedom in the Higgs about its vacuum. So this is a three-vector corresponding to the generators of S2. These are polymatrices. V is a constant here. And then I'm parameterizing small excitations in that direction. H field. okay? And the vacuum expectation value for these excitations will be zero. So in the vacuum, if I take vacuum expectation values of all these fields, this will just be P over root 2. Okay. Now I'm writing this as I'm making the SU2 doublet structure of this field very explicit here. This is the isospin 1/2, and this is the isospin minus 1/2. And you may recall that the hypercharge assignment, let me just write the matter content here. So H was a singlet under SU3. It was a doublet under SU2, which is, that's the structure I just made explicit. And then it had hypercharge 1/2. Okay. And the point is that, so if we look at the electromagnetic charge of these two components, right, we see that this one has charge, this upper component is charge 1, this lower component is neutral. So the vacuum itself doesn't, the vacuum itself is completely invariant under U1 transformations in this linear combination. So we'll see that this does not break that particular linear combination of U1s, and later we'll see that there'll be a massless gauge field associated with local gauge transformations under this generator. So it's QEM. Okay, so now let's go ahead and look at the at what we get in the Higgs sector here, where the Lagrangian is just the covariant derivative kinetic term for the Higgs. Now, a more formal and complete description of how the Higgs mechanism works in general, we will come back to in the third week, right at the beginning of the third week. And essentially, this is the word story, and I said this last time, the word story is that we have some symmetry that's spontaneously broken. For each broken generator, there's a pseudo-Goldstone boson that's massless. Okay? But if this is a local gauge symmetry, then those pseudo-Goldstone bosons are quote-unquote eaten by the massless vector bosons, and those scalar modes become the spin zero part of what now is a massive spin one vector boson. Okay. So we'll explain that in more detail in its full formal glory later on. But right now, I want to just get to the point where you see the standard model in a form that's useful for understanding real world phenomena at low energy. So let's go ahead and plug in this expansion. I'm going to skip a lot of the algebra and essentially summarize the form. So the potential in the Higgs sector, you'll see it'll just be some mass term and cubic and quartic terms. Okay. And then the kinetic terms . So this will have a kinetic term for the Higgs excitation here, this little H field, it's not surprising. Okay, but now recall that these covariant derivatives, remember they all have, let me just write it up here. Remember this is derivative plus I W mu plus I 1/2 d mu acting on H, right? And now you can anticipate that that when you set H to its VEV, these terms are going to give rise to mass terms for some set of the vector bosons. Okay. Now this this notation, I've suppressed all of the SU2 indices, but remember that in this notation, H is an SU2 column vector. And the W's here are an SU2 matrix that acts on that. Okay. So So the entries in that matrix are just particular combinations of the individual gauge boson fields. Okay. I think I wrote that down last time, so I won't repeat it here. Okay, so if we then work, if we work this out, now I'll go ahead and expand this out where my generators are polymatrices. So I'm now going to write this out in its full, you know, full glory here. We get a nice combination of mass terms. Okay, now when I write 3, 1, and 2, I'm referring, this is referring to the SU2 index in the adjoint representation. So you remember that, remember this matrix here, there was a W1 mu of x, tau1 plus W2 of x, tau2 plus W3 of x, tau3. And these terms drop out of the Lagrangian. Okay. Okay. So it's convenient to go ahead and introduce what we'll now call charged W bosons and Z bosons and the photon. Okay. We're going to diagonalize all these mass terms. Well, I've already written it in a form that's basically diagonal. We just got to give these names. Okay. So. All right, you can see there's a combination here, and these are CP conjugate. You see that under conjugation, right? This is the conjugate of that. So we'll identify this with a W plus W minus vector boson. Okay. Why do I say plus minus? The plus minus actually is referring to the electromagnetic charge. Okay. So we'll go ahead and normalize it. So that's this combination. Yeah, okay. Okay, and there's a neutral Z boson in here. Now I'm going to introduce the Weinberg angle in just a second, but let me just write it like this. Sorry, I skipped a step. There's no gauge couplings here. Remember how we had all the gauge couplings in the kinetic terms? Okay. But if we want to normalize the kinetic terms for these massive fields in the usual fashion, it's useful now to actually move the gauge couplings back into these terms, okay, and get them out of the kinetic terms. Okay. So actually, all the W fields, I'll just rescale to G2W. And the hypercharge field, I'll rescale. Okay, so this will move. This will normalize kinetic terms. In the usual way. Okay. So I haven't done that here, but if I do that, then we'll see that the mass terms are diagonal with the following combinations of the vector bosons. Okay, so this angle here is, this is known as this theta W, this is known as the Weinberg angle. And essentially it's just G2. Now the reason you can anticipate that the mass terms are not going to be B mu minus W mu is because when I reinstate the gauge terms to normalize the kinetic terms, I'm picking up different coefficients for these guys. So I need to do a rotation to diagonalize it. And that's what this rotation is. So this is the Weinberg angle. Okay. Now the orthogonal combination is what will turn out to be the photon field in QED. And again, it's a linear combination of the SU2 cross U1 Gauge bosons. This is the photon. Okay. And so this kinetic term that we had before is just the usual, it's this piece, and now we just have simple, properly normalized mass terms for the neutral Z, and then we have a mass term for the charge W's. Okay. Now, there's also Higgs couplings, which I'll write in this fashion. And you'll see that this Higgs field will always couple like mass to the W, the Zs, and the fermions when we get to them. That's because all these mass terms are violating SU2. And the presence of this Higgs field is keeping track of that. Okay. What are those masses? Again, I'm skipping the algebra, but if you keep track of what all these terms are, the masses are for the W's are just in these conventions, not surprisingly, controlled by the Higgs-Vev. And Z mass, similarly. And just note that there's a simple relation between the W mass, the Z mass, and the Weinberg angle at tree level. Okay.
How do we get the product MZ in second line? And we have masses and age as well in one form.
Here?
Yes, and H out of brackets.
Note that I pulled out factors of V out front here. Okay. So, I mean, all of this still has mass dimension. This still has the right number of mass dimensions. Is that what you're worried about?
So those are the interactions between the Higgs and the bosons, right?
Yeah. Yeah, these are not mass terms in the Lagrangian.
Right.
These are couplings between the Higgs and the Z and W's. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to write it in a way that makes it completely clear that it's the mass terms that control this coupling. Okay. Essentially, what we'll do is everywhere we see a Higgs, we'll write it as an H over. We'll write it as a Higgs over its Vev. And that term will appear universally throughout the Lagrangian. And then the couplings to the fields will always be controlled by the masses of those fields. OK. All right, so that's the story in the gauge boson sector. We're not quite ready to do calculations yet. I want to just quickly summarize how this works out in the lepton sector. So remember that we had these Yukawa terms between the Higgs doublet and, say, the lepton and the quark fields. So let me just do just one example. Okay, so here's an example. So for example, we had, let me see if I can remember how this, yeah, we had like an E bar, an L, H dagger combination. Okay. Now, when I send H to its bev, and this term, this is H naught. So when I send H to H naught, only one of the I3 components actually picks up a non-zero contribution. Okay, right? You see, you've got a zero entry here. So you should expect one linear combination of states between the to not pick up a mass. So these operators here will turn into E bar E combinations, okay? But they won't give rise to any couplings that involve this new field here, okay? So in particular, let me just keep track of all of this. So suppose I started out with a Yukawa coupling. I'm gonna just do this for one family. I'm gonna ignore the fact that I have three generations and I have some arbitrary Yukawa matrix, okay? I just to spell out how this works. So there's some Yukawa coupling, right? There's the then there's this product of fields. The V here over root 2 will just come out front. So you'll have a V y over root 2. Okay. And then you get this E bar E term. But you have no E bar new term. Okay. This combination here we identify with the mass. All right. And of course, all of this, there's a complex conjugate as well. I've been dropping the complex conjugate. But what that means is that the Yukawa terms, so for example, there's this Yukawa term, which had, I'll just write it again. You had Y E bar L H dagger. This goes to VY over root 2 E bar E, which is just, we'll just identify this with the electron mass, E bar E, okay? Plus complex conjugate. So when I write it here, this should be E bar E plus E bar dagger, E dagger, okay? But this, you may recall, in Dirac notation, is a Dirac mass term where the field, the Dirac field, is just built out of these two component biospinners in the following fashion. Okay. So in the lepton sector, the Yukawa couplings with the Higgs give rise to the Dirac mass terms for the electron, the muon, and the tau. And the masses are controlled by the Yukawa couplings, not surprisingly. Now, there's a completely analogous story that happens in the quark sector, but you may recall that in the quark sector, we couldn't fully diagonalize the Yukawa matrices. We didn't have enough freedom to do that. Okay. But let me just summarize what you have in the lepton sector. So this is the lepton Yukawa. This will contain, I'm now reinstating those Higgs excitations, okay, just to see how the Higgs couples. But now you'll have mass terms for all of these states. Now I'm using E mu tau explicitly, just to make contact with the names that we're used to using for these fields. Okay, plus complex conjugate. So again, I said I would try to write the Higgs as appearing universally, like Higgs over its web everywhere, just to illustrate the fact that it couples in proportion to mass. Okay. Now there's a very similar structure in the quark sector. So we decided we would dedicate probably a lecture to flavor physics in the standard model and understanding what the consequences are of not being able to remove all of that Yukawa structure in the quark sector. Okay? Question is, what happens to that CKM matrix? Right? We couldn't completely diagonalize the Yukawa couplings. But after electroweak symmetry breaking, when you diagonalize the mass terms, all of the quarks pick up Dirac mass terms. Those masses are, and the couplings of those quarks to the Higgs are controlled by those masses. And then that CKM matrix, we usually move to the couplings between the vector bosons and those quarks. Okay, and that part I'll write out for you right now. But I'm gonna sort of skip the procedure where we write out the Dirac mass terms for the quarks. Okay. All right. So let's do vector matter couplings. And I think I'll start here. Okay. So we just took care of the Higgs part of the Lagrangian. We took care of the Yukawa part. So now let's go back to the kinetic terms for the fermion fields and see what those look like. Okay. So essentially, we're going back to the matter sector. Remember that these were all things of the form, you know, for example, we had L dagger, sigma bar mu, d mu L, right? And there was E mu tau generations, one for each, plus all the other matter content. I'm not going to write that out. So you see, these are going to give rise to terms in the interaction, terms in the Lagrangian, that will always look like some vector field times a current. Okay. So everything I'm about to write down will take this form. Okay. So first, let's focus on the lepton sector. And the Lagrangian contains, I'm going to write down QED. So we have the familiar looking QED terms coupled to the electromagnetic current. Let's see, I'm going to drop my bar notation here. Where I sum over all the generations. So even though I use the symbol E here, you can replace this with a mu field and a tau field. Okay. So this is electromagnetism. Okay. Now, I don't think I wrote this before, but this coefficient that appears here, this thing we identify with the electric charge in QED, this is a product of the hypercharge and electroweak couplings. Another way it's often written is just that the electric charge is the SU2 charge rotated by the Weinberg angle. Okay, now we also have charged current interactions. Sorry, I need a little bit more space. So. Okay, so the charge current interactions, again, they all take the form of a vector current coupling. So there's a charge current coupling to the W minus that involves now neutrinos. So let's see. Again, this I index, this is the generation index, okay? You should always think of this as a summation over E, mu, tau types. There's a coupling to the this is just the conjugate piece. Okay. So these are charged currents. Interactions. So already here, a wide variety of phenomena can be accounted for. So QED lives here. And the charge current interactions, these are responsible for things like beta decay. They live here. Okay. And then we have neutral currents, which historically were the last piece that we discovered experimentally. Neutral currents are mediated by the Z boson. I'll write them like this. Okay, and they involve only the left-handed fields. So if I write this in Dirac in a Dirac form, you'll see left-handed projectors all over the place. Likewise up here. Yeah, I'm only going to write the standard model once. then we'll actually start calculating with it. Okay. Did I get everything? Good, good. Just dropped all my flavor indices. Okay. All right, I haven't made that explicit, but I've got these flavor indices appearing everywhere. But note that all of the flavors couple the same way to the photon, to the charge currents, and to the neutral currents. Sometimes goes by the name of lepton flavor universality. All right. And this will have interesting consequences and decays of things like charged pions. We'll get to that momentarily. Okay. Now, I think this problem, this week we're going to have a number of problems on computations of basic reactions in the electroweak sector involving, say, muon decay. So in cosmic rays, we see muons. Those muons decay. In collider experiments, we produce muons. They decay. So you can work out from the standard model electroweak sector using these terms. You can just work out predictions for the lifetime and the decay properties. Okay. So muon decay will be mediated, for example, by these charge current reactions. Okay, now that's the lepton sector. What about the quark sector? The quark sector takes a very similar form. I'm going to write it down once because you'll need it later on for the problem sets, perhaps in tutorial. Okay. Okay, now there's a lot more quarks than there are leptons. So I should adopt some somewhat more compact notation here. Okay, let me define a series of currents. Okay, and then I'll summarize the Lagrangian as a vector current coupling. So just like with the leptons, you should expect that there's going to be charged currents. And by charge, what do I mean? That's a current where the inner out state carries charge, and the other state is neutral. So you change charge by a unit. Neutral currents don't change charge. So charge current, oops, this is the quark sector. I should make that clear. Okay, so we have a charge current. Okay, now it's in the charge currents that we put the CKM matrix, okay? When we diagonalize the mass terms, we can get rid of all that CKM structure there, but we can't get rid of it completely. That's what I argued in the last lecture. So this is where it'll live. And essentially what this means is that the charge currents aren't going to respect individual quark flavor numbers. Charged currents are going to allow things like up quarks to convert into down quarks. Okay. So let me try to write that here. I'm trying to be consistent with my notation from the last lecture. So this is the CKM matrix. UJ. Okay. The up and the down, these up and down fields, these were the components of the Q. Okay. Remember that this Q, this has a U and a D in it. Likewise, there's the conjugate current, which is just the U dagger I UI J U DJ. Okay. There's a neutral current. So this is charged. This is neutral. Fortunately, this one's relatively simple. Now the CKM structure doesn't show up in the neutral currents at all. So it's nice and diagonal. And finally, we have an electromagnetic current. So this is the EM current. So this is the QED thing. All right. Now, you shouldn't be surprised to see two-thirds here. That's the electromagnetic charge of the quarks in the up-type sector. So we'll have a U dagger. And then we have the down type quarks, which have charge minus a third. Okay. Okay, a couple of observations are in order. So the CKM structure, and this is the thing, and remember, it's that CKM matrix that violates individual quark flavor number. Remember in the lepton sector, because we could diagonalize everything away, individual rephasings of the lepton flavor for E, mu, tau rephasings, those were invariant. Okay, so that gave rise to three conserved quantum numbers, at least at the classical level. Whereas because of this CKM matrix, the only thing that was left invariant, the only U1, is a common rotation of all the flavors together. Okay, so there was just a quark number or a baryon number. Okay, so the thing that violates quark number, it shows up in the charged currents. All right. Whereas we don't see it in the neutral currents. Now, note that the other thing that's worth noting is that whereas the electromagnetic part of the standard model, QED, it's completely vector-like. And by vector-like, I mean that we can write everything. The mass terms are vector-like. They're Dirac mass terms. So a Dirac fermion, remember, it's got two left-handed fields that carry opposite charges, okay? So they show up in the current in a vector-like fashion, right? You see there's the left-handed field here that carries charge two-thirds, and there's the left-handed field here which carries charge two-thirds, which is the left-handed part of the, well, sorry, this is the, should be a minus sign here. No, okay, good. I've got it conjugated. Right, this is the conjugated field for the antiparticle that would create a state with charge minus two-thirds. Okay? So in other words, I could have written this in a more familiar form, where it would just be the electromagnetic charge, and then we'd have a Dirac fermion with, okay, so this is a Dirac fermion. For the up-type and the down-type quarks, okay? So this would be the up-type, and this would be the down-type. Okay? Yeah?
So far, this means the total number of quarks is the same, but they can change up and down?
The charge currents can change up quarks into down-type quarks. Quark number is conserved, yes. So quark number is conserved, so quark number is conserved, but what I'm trying to emphasize, I'm not trying to emphasize with the secant matrix that the up type can convert to the down type. That's just a property of the fact that the W currents, I mean, they're mediating transitions that violate isospin. That's not surprising. They transform non-trivially under weak isospin. But this structure here is meant to indicate that, say, a charm quark, so a totally different generation, can transition into a down quark. Okay, and you can actually, and those transition across generations. Okay. And that's controlled by the secant structure. Whereas in QED, QED actually by itself preserves flavor number. Okay. So photon-mediated transitions don't change generation number. That preserves quark flavor. It's just the charge currents in the weak sector that violate that.
So how does pi zero decay to two photons?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so the pi zero decays through two photons through an anomaly operator. Okay, but that's we need to actually get to working out quantum mechanical effects in the standard model. So we have a whole lecture dedicated to that again in the third week with flavor. That's an excellent question. Okay, because the pi plus and the pi minus, they decay like you would expect. I mean, they're built out of these UU bar pairs, right? I mean, just to sort of answer your question, I mean, you can sort of anticipate that when you have things like mesons now, and you have these UU bar configurations, right, you'll be able to imagine, so you have a UU bar in some bound state, right? They can pair up. Well, sorry. Let's take the charge meson here. Okay, so this is the UD bar. They'll be able to pair up through these charge currents, and then they'll be able to decay into leptons, right? So these will account for decays like pi plus, pi minus goes into a charged lepton or a neutrino. Okay, they'll be mediated by reactions like this. So meson weak decay will look like this. Okay. Whereas to understand the pi zero decay through electromagnetic effects, we'll need to understand anomalies first. And then, of course, muon decay. So then you'll have things like muon decay. Right, and that'll just be a Feynman diagram where it's the muon neutrino, and then you have a W that gives rise to an electron. Similarly for taus. Okay, so these will appear in your problem set. Now the last thing that I didn't write down explicitly is that these quarks also couple to the gluons. Now I wrote it down before, I'm not gonna write it down again. I mean, these are just the gluon field strengths coupling to the color current. All right, it takes this form. We haven't touched the SU3 sector though with the Higgs mechanism. So it's as I said before, when SU3 when the SU3 interactions become strong at a GeV or so, all of the particle states, the quarks that are charged under SU3 have to confine. They form SU3 singlets, and then we have our mesons and baryons. Okay, I think everything I just wrote down, all of this, this should allow you to get started at least on tree-level calculations of standard model reactions that can account for a huge array of phenomenon. Now, we're not quite equipped to deal with QCD at low energies where things are strongly interacting and where this formulation of the theory isn't quite applicable. Remember, at low energies, when expanding around the QCD vacuum, the excitations are mesons and baryons, whereas I've told you about quarks and gluons. Okay? So we need to use an effective field theory to treat that. But if we were to look at very high energy reactions, then the more appropriate degrees of freedom are the quarks and the gluons, and you can use this setup to do perturbative calculations. Okay, but that sort of brings us to our to the next topic for this course. Okay, which is really, now that we've familiarized ourselves with the building blocks of the standard model, in other words, the building blocks that we actually see in the universe, all of the particles, we've seen some of their interactions, we've seen some of the symmetries that are exhibited by these interactions. So I think it's actually worth understanding why we go about describing all of these particle interactions in a quantum mechanical theory that respects Lorentz invariance, why it takes the form of a field theory. Okay. Now, part of the reason I want to go through this, and I'll try to do this remaining 10 minutes today, tomorrow, and the first part of Monday, is that we're going to construct specific effective field theories, where essentially we're going to isolate particular parts of the universe, of the standard model, particular particle content, and we're going to use knowledge of the symmetries that the interactions respect to construct different field theories that don't look like the standard model, but they will package exactly the same physics. Okay? That procedure works all over the place. Okay? We can pick some region we want to study, we can construct an effective field theory for it, and we can then and that greatly simplifies our ability to actually understand the actual predictions within the standard model. Now, I realize I didn't tell you, there's one more piece of information you need to actually do calculations in your problem set. In QFT 1 and 2, did you work with any massive vector propagators at all? Okay, I'm just going to tell you, because I mean, if you actually gauge fix the standard model, I'm like not going through any of the RSI gauge fixing procedures. But suffice it to say, if we go through that procedure of gauge fixing within the standard model so that we can actually do calculations, and we use an RSI gauge fixing procedure. So you may have seen that when you studied Yang-Mills theory. You can nod if you've seen it. It's useful to work in unitary gauge. It's not always easiest to work in unitary gauge. Unitary gauge, this is RSI goes to infinity. If you don't know what this is, we should talk about it in tutorial, because you should have some rough idea of how to gauge fix in the standard model, or how to gauge fix, period, in a Yang-Mills theory to do calculations. But the propagator of things like the W plus, W minus, and the Z, right, these are massive vector bosons, they take the form P squared plus M squared. And now the propagator acquires a modified piece here. So that accounts for the longitudinal degrees of freedom being exchanged. Okay, so this with the Lagrangian I gave you and this piece of information, now you're equipped to do calculations, okay? At tree level. Yeah, so that's a bit more complicated.
Don't we need it?
No, not for the problems that I'm going to give you this week. Okay. And it turns for a lot of the reactions we're going to study at low energies. It's like I said, the gluons are not the right degrees of freedom to use. Okay. So when we return to say LHC physics in the third week, then I may make some remarks about that. Actually, Natalia will make some remarks about that. Okay. All right. Are there any further questions before we totally change gears here? I know from last time there was some confusion about the notation I was using. I've been using a kind of hypercompact notation where I've been suppressing all my SU3 indices, and in some cases I've been suppressing my SU2 indices. I've been suppressing spinner indices. Okay. I mean, in practice, there's, you know, there's well over 100 degrees of freedom in the standard model. So if I wrote every, I mean, I'd have a lot of indices floating around if I didn't do that. I think in tutorial today, though, if there's further questions about that, that's a good time to go over it. Okay, so now we're going to go back to the very beginning. Just to quantum mechanics, okay? And we're going to ask the question, how do you build a quantum mechanical theory of particles in a way that respects Lorentz invariance, okay? We know we have particles. We're going to assume the laws of quantum mechanics for now. We know that nature appears translation invariant, appears rotationally invariant, the laws of physics at least. So the only thing we're going to have to add to this story are boosts, okay, to complete Lorentz transformations. And we want to understand what the consequences are of demanding boost invariance. Now, I'm going to have to introduce some machinery here, some basic kinematics, okay? All right, but let me just make it really clear what I mean. So states, so I'm going to be working in the Heisenberg picture here. So states will just be some, you know, we'll have states or vectors psi in some space. Okay, we're going to have to characterize these states completely. Okay. And we say that observable quantities always end up being some inner product of these states squared. Okay. So amplitudes, just these inner products. Okay. So if there's actually some symmetry in the physics, just mechanistically, how do we express the fact that there is a symmetry that the laws respect? Okay, so if there is a symmetry, we say that there's a unitary transformation that realizes this symmetry on the states in the theory. Okay. So in other words, if I have some sort of physical process, and I'm computing the consequences of that physical process in terms of the squares of amplitudes, if I want the physics to be the same, depending on, so let's say I compute all my observables here, but if I decide I'm going to be some observer living in some highly boosted frame or a translated frame or a rotated frame, all of my observables I would compute just by taking the states and mapping them under this unitary transformation. Well, under the symmetry transformation, lambda just describes the group. Okay, this could be rotations, could be translations, whatever. If this is unitary, right, then obviously the amplitudes will be invariant. They won't change. Okay. So it's just the statement that all of the observable consequences that I could calculate will not change. So that's what we literally mean when we say there's a symmetry in the theory. So now we want to do this for Lorentz invariance. So in classes on quantum mechanics, you've probably done this for translation invariance and rotational invariance. But it appears that the laws of physics are invariant under boosts as well. Okay, so I think you've seen this in your relativity courses, but we're going to talk about Poincaré transformations. So Poincaré transformations have a natural realization in, say, coordinate space, where you talk about four vectors, where four vectors transform under, this is a Lorentz transformation. It's Lorentz, x nu. Or you can translate. Okay, so together is Poincaré. Now, if we want to try to build a theory that realizes a symmetry like this, we're going to want a set of states and operators that act on those states that realize this group of transformations, okay? So basically, we're going to want to have an association between Lorentz transformations. So now lambda will be a, will always mean a Lorentz transformation. This is some combination of rotations and boosts. So to every pair of transformations, we want there to be some operator. And we want that operator to be unitary, acting on the states, okay? And so when we say that an observer is boosted with respect to another observer, what that means is that that observer, if in one reference frame you have a set of states, you have a state psi, that boosted observer should be talking about the state u of psi, okay? Now, as you may recall from your group theory courses, we can describe this set of transformations in a local way by looking at small transformations about the origin. So we can talk about the generators of Poincaré transformations. So for example, we can talk about translations. So we can say translations are generated by momentum and time translation generators, okay? So it'll take this form. So this is just the, these are just the generators of the finite transformations. So for example, this notation P0 is time translation. This will be identified with the Hamiltonian, and the PI are space translation. And we can also then have the Lorentz transformations and introduce a local parameterization for those. Now, this is a fairly, I'm not going to, sort of a more familiar way of writing this is to write this as a boost and a rotation. So boosts are just, so in this notation, right, 0i equals boosts. Rotations. Okay. And the reason it's convenient to write these generators of Lorentz transformations, this is an anti-symmetric, these are anti-symmetric in mu indices. I can write the Lie algebra that characterizes this group in a simple way in terms of J mu nu. You've probably seen it before, so let me just write it in a slightly different way, just in terms of the rotations and boosts. Right, so so rotations are what you'd guess, right? These are just the slide. Okay. Now, boosts transform nicely under rotations, as you'd expect. Momentum also transforms nicely under rotations. You're used to that as well. And of course, just let me single out the Hamiltonian. It's a zero. Now, it's the boosts that are a little unusual. So two boosts are a rotation. Or rather, the changing the order of operation of a boost is a rotation. And changing the order of operation of translation and boosting is a time translation when it's done in the same direction. And finally, changing the order of operation of boosting and time translating is a spatial translation. OK, so this is the part that's, even if you've studied it in some detail, still tends to be counterintuitive. I apologize if you can't. Yeah, let me raise it here. Oh, wait a minute. Is this even, can I even raise this? Oh. Sorry, that didn't help. OK, they're all zero anyway. Okay, I'm out of time, so let me just give you an idea of where I want to go with this. I want to define a set of states that intuitively make contact with what we're used to calling particles. Okay, so we already have some idea of what kind of information you need to label a particle. We label particles according to their energy, to their momentum, and we've also observed that particles appear to carry things like intrinsic spin. Okay, so there's some set of labels that go into defining what we mean by a particle state. Now, we can rationalize that in a more formal way by exhibiting a set of states that are eigenstates of the translation generators and then asking ourselves, how can those other labels transform under Lorentz transformations? Okay. And we'll find that the objects that transform nicely, sort of in mathematical terminology, they furnish representations of the Poincaré group. Okay. And if you look at those representations, you'll find that there's objects in there that look just like ordinary particles. They're labeled by form momentum, and it turns out that the only thing they can be labeled by are things like spin. Spin if they're massive, and something like helicity if they're massless. Okay. And this is just a consequence of the structure of boosts and translations, described, summarized here in their local form. Now, after we do that, that gives us a set of objects we can work with, particle states, right? And then it becomes our task, well, it becomes, I mean, essentially in defining particle states, you'll see how these U operators should act on them. And then the challenge is to construct dynamics that preserves or that has those transformations as a symmetry, okay? So we can introduce something like an S matrix that describes scattering of free particles. And we want to find, can you build a non-trivial S matrix that is invariant under these Lorentz transformations, acting on all the in and out states? Okay. I'll use a Hamiltonian formulation for doing that. Again, I want to start from quantum mechanics, and I want to make unitarity in quantum mechanics totally manifest. So I'll use a Hamiltonian setup. And essentially, when we you've seen in your classes how this works for rotations and translations. So largely, this will be about seeing what the consequences are of boost invariance. Okay. And we'll find that we sort of get pushed in a direction where it's convenient to talk about single particle states as packaged in fields. Okay. And once we get there, we can start to see all sorts of connections between spin and statistics. We can see that something like antiparticles is necessary to ensure boost invariance. We'll also see that it's not possible to introduce a non-trivial S matrix that preserves particle number. Lorentz invariant quantum mechanical theories of particles will always have to violate particle number. Okay? You can try as hard as you want, but the reactions will always produce more particles. Now, we know this very well in the lab. It doesn't matter what particle type you've got. When you start doing high energy collisions, you can always produce them in pairs. You always end up violating particle number in one form or another once the energy exceeds the mass. Okay, and we'll see that that's actually a consequence of theories. It couldn't be any other way. Okay, so let's stop there for today.